on a National Academy of Sciences research associateship. There, one day, he had a call from a top general in the Pentagon. He says, "Would you mind coming to talk to us?" Gaul went over to the Pentagon to be interrogated by a room full of U.S. Army generals. They put their question in many different ways, but Gaul said, "It was always the same question. Please explain to me how it is possible you guys use the same rifles we use, drive the same tanks we drive, fly the same airplanes we fly, and you are doing so well winning all of the battles, and we are not. I know it's not the weapons. It must be the psychology. How do you pick the soldiers for combat?" For the next 5 hours, they picked my brain about one thing, our selection process. Later, when he was a university professor, Danny would tell students, "When someone says something, don't ask yourself if it is true. Ask what it might be true of." That was his intellectual instinct, his natural first step to the mental hoop, to take whatever someone had just said to him and try not to tear it down, but to make sense of it. The question the Israeli military had asked him, which personalities are best suited to which military roles? It turned out to make no sense. And so Danny had gone and answered a different, more fruitful question. How do we prevent the intuition of interviewers from screwing up their assessment of Army recruits? He'd been asked to divine the character of the nation's youth. Instead, he'd found out something about people who try to divine other people's character. Remove their gut feelings, and their judgments improved. He'd been handed a narrow problem and discovered a broad truth. The difference between Danny and the next 999,999 psychologists is his ability to find the phenomenon and then explain it in a way that applies to other situations, said Dale Griffin, a psychologist of the University of British Columbia. It looks like luck, but he keeps doing it. A different, more ordinary person would have left the experience brimming with confidence. In a stroke, 21-year-old Danny Kahneman had exerted more influence upon the Israeli army, the institution on which the society depended for its survival, than any psychologist had ever done or ever would do. The obvious next step for him was to go off and get his Ph.D. and become Israel's leading expert in personality assessment and selection processes. Harvard was home to some of the leading figures in the field, but Danny decided, without anyone's help, that he wasn't bright enough to go to Harvard, and didn't bother to apply. Instead, he went to Berkeley. When he returned to Hebrew University as a young assistant professor in 1961, after 4 years away, he was freshly inspired by personality studies being done by the psychologist Walter Mischel. In the late 1960s, Mischel created these wonderfully simple tests on children that wound up revealing a lot about them. In what became known as the Marshmallow Experiment, Mischel put 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids in a room alone with their favorite treat, a pretzel stick, a marshmallow, and told them that if they could last a few minutes without eating the treat, they'd receive a second treat. A small child's ability to wait turned out to be correlated with his IQ and his family circumstances and some other things as well. Tracking the kids through life, Mischel later found that the better a 5-year-old resisted the temptation, the higher his future SAT scores and his sense of self-worth, and the lower his body fat and the likelihood he'd suffer from some addiction. Gripped by a new enthusiasm, Danny designed a bunch of marshmallow test-like experiments. He even coined a phrase for what he was doing, the psychology of single questions. He arranged for Israeli kids on camping trips, this was just one example, to be offered a choice between sleeping in a single tent, a 2-person tent, or an 8-person tent. Perhaps their answers, Danny thought, would say something about their tendency to affiliate with a group. The idea yielded either no findings or findings he couldn't replicate in a subsequent experiment, and so he gave up. "I wanted to be a scientist," he said, "and I thought I can't be a scientist unless I can replicate myself. I couldn't replicate myself." Doubting himself once again, he abandoned the study of personality, deciding he had no talent for it.
Chapter 3. The Insider. Amnon Rapoport was just 18 years old when he was identified by the Israeli Army's new selection system as leadership material. They'd made him a tank commander. "I didn't even know there was a tank corps," he said. One night in October 1956, he drove his tank into Jordan to avenge the murder of several Israeli civilians. On these raids, you never knew what decisions you might have to make quickly. Shoot or hold fire. Kill or let live, live or die. A few months earlier, an Israeli soldier Amnon's age had been captured by the Syrians. He decided to kill himself before they could question him. When the Syrians sent his body back, the Israeli army found a note in his toenail. I never betrayed. On that night, in October 1956, Amnon's first decision had been to stop firing. His job was to bombard the second floor of a Jordanian police building until Israeli paratroopers stormed the ground floor. He worried about killing his own men. After he'd stopped shelling, he heard over his tank's radio reports from the ground. And all of a sudden, the reality hit me. This was not just an adventure with heroes and villains acting their role. People were dying. The paratroopers were Israel's elite fighting force. Their unit, in hand-to-hand combat, was suffering serious casualties, and yet their reports from the battle to Amnon's ears inside the tank sounded calm, almost casual. There was no panic, he said. Indeed, no change of intonation and hardly any expression of emotion. These Jews had become Spartans. How had that happened? He wondered how he would fare in hand-to-hand combat. He aspired to be a warrior, too. 2 weeks later, he drove his tank into Egypt in what turned out to be the start of a military invasion. In the fog of battle, he was strafed not just by Egyptian but also Israeli warplanes. His most vivid memory was of an Egyptian MiG-15 diving straight down on his tank while he, with his head above the turret to maintain a 360-degree view of the battlefield, shouted at his driver to zig and zag to avoid being hit. It felt like the MiG was on a special assignment to blow off his head. A few days later, desperate Egyptian soldiers in full retreat approached Amnon's tank with their arms in the air. They begged for water and protection from the Bedouins who hunted them for their rifles and boots. The day before, he was murdering these people. Now all he felt toward them was pity. He marveled again at how easy it is to shift from an efficient killing machine to a compassionate human being, and how quick the switch may be. How did that happen? After the battles, Amnon just wanted to get away from it all. I was a little bit wild after 2 years in the tank, he said. I wanted to go as far away as possible. Flying out of the country was too expensive. Israelis in the 1950s didn't talk about combat stress or its discontents. They just dealt with it. He took a job in the copper mine in the desert just north of the Red Sea, said to be one of the legendary mines of King Solomon. His math skills were better than any of the other workers, most of whom were prison labor, and so he was made the mine's bookkeeper. Among the conveniences that King Solomon's mine was unable to provide was a toilet, or toilet paper. I went out to take a shit. I saw a note in the newspaper that I took to wipe my ass. It said they were opening a psychology department at Hebrew University. He was 20 years old. What he knew of psychology was Freud and Jung. There were not many textbooks in psychology in Hebrew, but the subject interested him. He couldn't say why. Nature had called. Psychology had answered. Entrance into Israel's first psychology department, unlike entrance into most Hebrew university departments, was to be competitive. A few weeks after he'd read the ad in the newspaper, Amnon stood in line outside the monastery that served as Hebrew University, waiting to take a series of bizarre tests, including one designed by Danny Kahneman, who had written a page of prose in a language he had invented so that applicants might attempt to decipher its grammatical structure. The line of applicants ran down the block. There were only 20 or so spots in the new department, but hundreds of people wanted into it. An amazing number of young Israelis in 1957 wanted to know what made people tick. The talent was also incredible. Of the 20 people admitted, 19 went on to earn their doctorates, and the one who didn't was a woman who, scoring one of the top marks on the admissions test, then had her career derailed by children. Israel without a psychology department was like Alabama without a football team. In line beside Amnon stood a small, pale, baby-faced soldier. He looked about 15, but he wore, almost absurdly, the high rubber-soled boots and crisp uniform and red beret of the Israeli paratrooper, the new Spartan. Then he started to speak. His name was Amos Tversky. Amnon wouldn't remember exactly what he had said, but he'd remember vividly how he'd felt about it. I was not as smart as he was. I understood it immediately. To his fellow Israelis, Amos Tversky somehow was at once the most extraordinary person they had ever met and the quintessential Israeli. His parents were among the pioneers who had fled Russian anti-Semitism in the early 1920s to build a Zionist nation. His mother, Genia Tversky, was a social force and political operator who became a member of the first Israeli parliament, and the next four after that. She sacrificed her private life for public service and didn't agonize greatly about the choice. She was often gone. She spent 2 years of Amos's early childhood in Europe, helping the U.S. Army liberate the concentration camps and resettle the survivors. Upon her return, she spent more time at the Knesset in Jerusalem than at home. Amos had a sister, but she was 13 years older, and he was raised, in effect, as an only child. The person who did most of that raising was his father, a veterinarian who spent much of his time treating livestock. Israelis couldn't afford pets. Yosef Tversky, the son of a rabbi, despised religion and loved Russian literature, and found a great deal of amusement in what came out of the mouths of his fellow human beings. His father had turned away from an early career in medicine, Amos explained to friends, because he thought animals had more real pain than people and complained a lot less. Yosef Tversky was a serious man. At the same time, when he talked about his life and work, he brought his son to his knees with laughter about his experiences and about the mysteries of existence. "This work is dedicated to my father, who taught me to wonder," Amos would one day write at the opening of his Ph.D. dissertation. Amos was fond of saying that interesting things happen to people who could weave them into interesting stories. He, too, could tell a story with startlingly original effect. He spoke with a slight lisp that reminded some of the way that Catalan spoke Spanish. He was so pale that his skin was almost translucent. Whether he was speaking or listening, his pale blue eyes darted back and forth, as if searching for an approaching thought. Even as he spoke, he gave the impression of constant motion. He wasn't conventionally athletic. He was always small, but he was loose-jointed and fast, twitchy, and incredibly agile. He had an almost feral ability to run at great speed up and down mountains. One of his favorite tricks, he'd sometimes do this as he told a story, was to place himself on a high surface, whether a rock or a table or an army tank, and fall face first toward the ground. His body perfectly horizontal to the earth, he'd fall until people shrieked, and then he'd pull himself up at the last moment and somehow land on his feet. He loved the sensation of falling and the view of the world from above. Amos was also physically brave, or at least intent on seeming so. Not long after his parents moved him from Jerusalem in 1950 to the coastal city of Haifa, he found himself at a swimming pool with other kids. The pool had a 10-meter diving platform. The kids challenged him to jump off it. Amos was 12 years old, but didn't yet know how to swim. In Jerusalem, during the War of Independence, they hadn't had water to drink, much less to fill swimming pools with. Amos found a big kid and said, "I'm going to do this, but I need you to be in the pool when I land to pull me up from the bottom." Amos jumped, and the big kid rescued him from drowning and pulled him out of the pool. Entering high school, Amos, like all Israeli kids, needed to decide if he would specialize in math and science or in the humanities. The new society exerted great pressure on boys to study math and science. That's where the status was and the future careers. Amos had a gift for math and science, perhaps more than any other boy, and yet, alone among the bright boys in his class, and to the bemusement of all, he pursued the humanities, another risky leap into the unknown. He could teach himself math, Amos said, and he couldn't ignore the thrill of studying with the humanities teacher, a man named Baruch Kurzweil. "In contrast to most of the teachers who spread boredom and superficiality, I'm full of enjoyment and amazement in his classes in Hebrew literature and philosophy," Amos wrote to his older sister Ruth, who had moved to Los Angeles. Amos wrote poetry for Kurzweil and told people he planned to become a poet or a literary critic. He formed an intense private, possibly romantic relationship with a new student named Dalia Ravakovich. She turned up one day morosely in their high school class. After her father's death, she'd lived on a kibbutz, which she loathed, and bounced unhappily through a series of foster homes. She was the picture of social alienation, or at any rate the 1950s Israeli version of it, and yet Amos, the most popular kid in the school, took up with her. The other kids didn't know what to make of it. Amos still looked like a boy. Dalia seemed, in every way, already a grown woman. He loved the outdoors and games. She, well, when all the other girls went out to gym class, she sat at the window and smoked. Amos loved being with big groups of people. Dalia was a loner. It was only later, when Dahlia's poetry claimed Israel's highest literary prizes and she became a global sensation, that people said, "Oh, that made sense. Two geniuses." Just as it made sense after Baruch Kurzweil became Israel's most prominent literary critic that Amos had wanted to study with him. But it did, and it didn't. Amos was the most insistently upbeat person anyone knew. Dahlia, like Kurzweil, attempted suicide. Kurzweil succeeded. Like a lot of the Jewish kids in Haifa in the early 1950s, Amos joined a leftist youth movement called the Nahal. He was soon elected a leader. The Nahal, the word was an acronym for the Hebrew phrase meaning fighting pioneer youth, was a vehicle to move young Zionists from school onto kibbutzim. The idea was that they would serve as soldiers and guard the farm for a couple of years and then become farmers. During Amos's final year in high school, the swashbuckling Israeli general Moshe Dayan came to Haifa to speak to the students. A boy who happened to be in the audience recalls, "He says all those who go to the Nahal, raise your hands. A huge number did." Dayan says, "You are traitors. We don't want you growing tomatoes and cucumbers. We want you fighting." The next year, every youth group in Israel was asked to pick 12 kids out of every 100 to serve their country not as farmers, but paratroopers. Amos looked more like a Boy Scout than an elite soldier, but he volunteered immediately. Too light to qualify, he drank water until he made weight. At paratrooper school, Amos and the other young men were turned into symbols of the new country, warriors and killing machines. Cowardice wasn't an option. Once they'd proven that they could jump to the ground from a height of 18 feet without breaking anything, they were taken up in old World War II planes built of wood. Their propeller was at the same level as the door, but just in front of it, so there was this strong gust of wind to throw you backward the moment you stepped out. The light on the door was red. They checked each other's equipment until the light turned green, and one by one they moved forward. Anyone who hesitated was pushed out. The first few jumps, a lot of the young men hesitated. They needed a little push. One kid in Amos's group refused to jump and was ostracized for the rest of his life. "It took real bravery not to jump," a former paratrooper later said. Amos never hesitated. "He was always on the extreme end of enthusiastic when it came to jumping out of airplanes," recalls fellow paratrooper Uri Shamir. "He jumped 50 times, maybe more. He jumped behind enemy lines. He jumped into battle in 1956 in the Sinai campaign. Once he jumped by accident into a hornet's nest and was stung so badly he passed out." After university in 1961, he flew for the first time in his life without a parachute to graduate school in the United States. As his plane descended, he looked at the earth below with genuine curiosity, turned to the person sitting beside him, and said, "I've never landed." Soon after he joined the paratroopers, Amos became a platoon commander. "It is amazing how quickly one is able to adapt to a new way of life," he wrote to his sister in Los Angeles. "The boys my age were no different than I was, other than the two stripes on my arm. Now they salute me and follow my every command, to run and to crawl. And now this relationship is accepted, even by me, and seems natural to me." The letters Amos wrote home were censored and offer only a glimpse of his combat experience. He was sent on reprisal missions, which invited atrocities on both sides. He lost men and saved them. "During one of our payback missions, I saved one of my soldiers and received honorable mention," he wrote to his sister. "I did not think I had done anything heroic. I just wanted my soldiers to return home safely." There were other ordeals of which he did not write and seldom spoke. A sadistic senior Israeli officer wanted to test how far men could travel without their usual provisions and deprive them of water for great stretches. The experiment ended when one of Amos's men died of dehydration. Amos testified against his commanding officer at the latter's court-martial. One night, Amos's men threw a blanket over another sadistic officer's head and beat him savagely. Amos didn't join in the beating, but in the subsequent investigation, he helped the men who had done it avoid prosecution. "When they ask you questions, just bore them with lots of irrelevant details and they will be thrown off the scent," he told them, and it had worked. By late 1956, Amos was not merely a platoon commander, but a recipient of one of the Israeli Army's highest awards for bravery. During a training exercise in front of the general staff of the Israel Defense Forces, one of his soldiers was assigned to clear a barbed wire fence with a Bangalore torpedo. From the moment he pulled the string to activate the fuse, the soldier had 20 seconds to run for cover. The soldier pushed the torpedo under the fence, yanked the string, fainted, and collapsed on top of the explosive. Amos's commanding officer shouted for everyone to stay put and leave the unconscious soldier to die. Amos ignored him and sprinted from behind the wall that served as cover for his unit, grabbed the soldier, picked him up, hauled him 10 yards, tossed him on the ground, and threw himself on top of him. The shrapnel from the explosion remained in Amos for the rest of his life. The Israeli army did not bestow honors for bravery lightly. As he handed Amos his award, Moshe Dayan, who had watched the entire episode, said, "You did a very stupid and brave thing, and you won't get away with it again." Occasionally, people who watched Amos in action sensed that he was more afraid of being thought unmanly than he was actually brave. "He was always very gung-ho," recalled Uri Shamir. "I thought it was maybe compensation for being thin and weak and pale." At some point, it didn't matter. He compelled himself to be brave until bravery became a habit. And as his time in the army came to an end, he clearly sensed a change in himself. "I cannot rid myself of the feeling that you would almost not know me today," Amos wrote to his sister. "Letters cannot convey the drastic changes of a boy in an army uniform that you will meet. He will be very different from the young boy in khaki shorts that you left at the airport 5 years ago." Apart from that short note, Amos seldom mentioned his army experiences, in print or conversation, unless it was to tell a funny or curious story. How, for instance, during the Sinai campaign, his battalion captured a train of Egyptian fighting camels. Amos had never ridden a camel, but when the military operation ended, he won the competition to ride the lead camel home. He got seasick after 15 minutes and spent the next 6 days walking the caravan across the Sinai. Or how his soldiers, even in combat, refused to wear their helmets, claiming that the weather was too hot for them, and, "If a bullet is going to kill me, it has my name on it anyway." To which Amos said, "What about all those bullets addressed to whom it may concern?" More typically, Amos's stories began with some offhand observation of the world around him. Almost always when he encountered you, he would start the conversation with, "Did I tell you this story?" recalls Samuel Sataf, an Israeli mathematician. But the stories were not about him. He would say, for example, "You know, in an Israeli university meeting, everyone jumps in to speak because they think someone else might be about to say what they want to say. And in an American university faculty meeting, everyone is quiet because they think someone else will think to say what they want to say." And he'd be off on a disquisition on the differences between Americans and Israelis, how Americans believe tomorrow will be better than today, while Israelis were sure tomorrow would be worse. How American kids always came to class prepared, while Israeli kids never did the reading, but it was Israeli kids who always had the bold idea, and so on. To those who knew Amos best, Amos's stories were just an excuse to enjoy Amos. People who knew Amos could talk of nothing else, as one Israeli woman, a friend of long standing, put it. "There was nothing we liked to do more than to get together and talk about him, over and over and over." There were, for starters, the stories about the funny things Amos had said, usually directed at people whom he found full of themselves. He had listened to an American economist talk about how so-and-so was stupid and so-and-so was a fool, then said, "All your economic models are premised on people being smart and rational, and yet all the people you know are idiots." He'd heard Murray Gell-Mann, a Nobel laureate in physics, hold forth on seemingly every subject under the sun. After Gell-Mann was done, Amos said, "You know, Murray, there is no one in the world who is as smart as you think you are." Once after Amos gave a talk, an English statistician had approached him. "I don't usually like Jews, but I like you," the statistician said. Amos replied, "I usually like Englishmen, but I don't like you." The effect on others of whatever Amos said only led to even more stories about Amos. There was, to take just one example, the time that Tel Aviv University threw a party for a physicist who had just won the Wolf Prize. It was the discipline's second highest honor, and its winners, more often than not, went on to win the Nobel. Most of the leading physicists in the country came to the party, but somehow the prize winner ended up in the corner with Amos, who had recently taken an interest in black holes. The next day, the prize winner called his host to ask, "Who was that physicist I was talking to? He never told me his name." After some confusing back and forth, his hosts figured out that the man meant Amos, and they told him that Amos wasn't a physicist, but a psychologist. "It's not possible," the physicist said. "He was the smartest of all the physicists." The Princeton philosopher Avishai Margalit said, "No matter what the topic was, the first thing Amos thought was in the top 10%. This was such a striking ability. The clarity and depth of his first reaction to any problem, any intellectual problem, was something mind-boggling. It was as if he was right away in the middle of any discussion. Irv Biederman, a psychologist at the University of Southern California, said, "Physically, he was unremarkable. In a room full of 30 people, he'd be the last one you'd notice. And then he'd start to talk. Everyone who ever met him thought he was the smartest person they had ever met." The University of Michigan psychologist Dick Nisbet, after he'd met Amos, designed a one-line intelligence test. The sooner you figure out that Amos is smarter than you are, the smarter you are. He would walk into a room, recalled his close friend and collaborator Varda Lieberman, a mathematician. He didn't look special, and the way he dressed said nothing. He'd sit there quietly, and then he would open his mouth and speak, and in no time he became the light that all the butterflies fly to, and in no time everyone would look up to him wanting to hear what he would say. Even so, most of the stories people told about Amos had less to do with what came out of his mouth than with the unusual way he moved through the world. He kept the hours of a vampire. He went to bed when the sun came up and woke up at happy hour. He ate pickles for breakfast and eggs for dinner. He minimized quotidian tasks he thought a waste of time. He could be found in the middle of the day, having just woken up, driving himself to work while shaving and brushing his teeth in the rearview mirror. He never knew what time of day it was, said his daughter, Donna. It didn't matter. He's living in his own sphere, and you just happen to encounter him there. He didn't pretend to be interested in whatever others expected him to be interested in. God help anyone who tried to drag him to a museum or a board meeting. For those who like that sort of thing, that is the sort of thing they like, Amos liked to say, plucking a line from the Muriel Spark novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. He just skipped family vacations, says his daughter. He'd come if he liked the place, otherwise he didn't. The children didn't take it personally. They loved their father and knew that he loved them. He loved people, said his son Oren. He just didn't like social norms. A lot of things that most human beings would never think to do, to Amos, simply made sense. For instance, when he wanted to go for a run, he went for a run. No stretching, no jogging outfit, or for that matter, jogging. He'd simply strip off his slacks and sprint out his front door in his underpants and run as fast as he could until he couldn't run anymore. Amos thought people paid an enormous price to avoid mild embarrassment, said his friend Avishai Margalit, and he himself decided very early on it was not worth it. What all those who came to know Amos eventually realized was that the man had a preternatural gift for doing only precisely what he wanted to do. Varda Lieberman recalled visiting him one day and seeing a table with a week's worth of mail on it. They were tidy little stacks, one for each day, each filled with requests and entreaties and demands upon Amos's time. Job offers, offers of honorary degrees, requests for interviews and lectures, requests for help with some abstruse problem, bills. When the new mail came in, Amos opened anything that interested him and left the rest in its daily pile. Each day the new mail arrived and shoved the old mail down the table. When a pile reached the end of the table, Amos pushed it, unopened, off the edge into a waiting garbage can. The nice thing about things that are urgent, he liked to say, is that if you wait long enough, they aren't urgent anymore. I would say to Amos, I have to do this, or I have to do that, recalled his old friend Yeshu Kolodny, and he would say, no, you don't. And I thought, lucky man. There was this beautiful simplicity to Amos. His likes and dislikes could be inferred directly and accurately, and at all times from his actions. Amos's three children have vivid memories of watching their parents drive off to see some movie picked by their mother, only to have their father turn up back at their couch 20 minutes later. Amos would have decided in the first 5 minutes whether the movie was worth seeing, and if it wasn't, he'd just come home and watch Hill Street Blues, his favorite TV drama, or Saturday Night Live, he never missed it, or an NBA game, he was obsessed with basketball. He'd then go back and fetch his wife after her movie ended. They've already taken my money, he'd explain. Should I give them my time, too? If by some freak accident he found himself at a gathering of his fellow human beings that held no appeal for him, he'd become invisible. He'd walk into a room and decide he didn't want anything to do with it, and he would fade into the background and just vanish, says Donna. It was like a superpower, and it was absolutely an abnegation of social responsibility. He didn't accept social responsibility, and so graciously, so elegantly, didn't accept it. Occasionally, Amos offended someone. Of course he did. His darting pale blue eyes were enough to unsettle people who didn't know him. Their constant motion gave them the impression he wasn't listening to them, when the problem often was that he had listened too well. For him, the main thing is the people who don't know the difference between knowing and not knowing, says Avishai Margalit. If he thought you were a bore and there was nothing there, he could cut you like nothing. Those who knew him best learned how to rationalize whatever he had said or done. It never occurred to him that anyone with whom he wanted to spend time wouldn't want to spend time with him. He expected, first of all, to charm you, said Samuel Sataff, which was odd for such a smart person. He sort of invited people to love him, said Yeshu Kolodny. When you were on the good side of Amos, he was very easy to love, extremely easy. There was a competition around him. People competed for Amos. It was a very common thing for Amos's friends to ask themselves, I know why I like him, but why does he like me? Amnon Rappaport did not lack for admirers. He'd been famously brave in battle. Israeli women, taking in for the first time his blonde hair and tan skin and chiseled features, often decided he was the best-looking man they'd ever laid eyes on. One day he'd earn his Ph.D. in mathematical psychology and become a highly regarded professor, with his pick of the world's universities. And yet, he too, when he sensed that Amos liked him, wondered why. I know that what attracted me to Amos was how clever he was, said Amnon. I don't know what attracted him to me. I was supposed to be very handsome, maybe that. Whatever its source, the attraction was strong. From the moment they met, Amnon and Amos were inseparable. They sat side by side in the same classes. They lived in the same apartments. They spent summers hiking the country together. They were famously a pair. I think some people thought we were homosexual or something, said Amnon. Amnon also had the best seat in the house when Amos decided what he was going to do with his life. Hebrew University in the late 1950s required students to pick two fields of concentration. Amos had chosen philosophy and psychology. But Amos approached intellectual life strategically, as if it were an oil field to be drilled, and after 2 years of sitting through philosophy classes, he announced that philosophy was a dry well. I remember his words, recalled Amnon. He said, there is nothing we can do in philosophy. Plato solved too many of the problems. We can't have any impact in this area. There are too many smart guys and too few problems left, and the problems have no solutions. The mind-body problem was a good example. How are our various mental events, what you believe, what you think, related to our physical states? What is the relationship between our bodies and our minds? The question was at least as old as Descartes, but there was still no answer in sight, at least not in philosophy. The trouble with philosophy, Amos thought, was that it didn't play by the rules of science. The philosopher tested his theories of human nature on a sample size of one, himself. Psychology at least pretended to be a science. It kept at least one hand at all times on hard data. A psychologist might test whatever theory he devised on a representative sample of humanity. His theories might be tested by others and his findings reproduced or falsified. If a psychologist stumbled upon a truth, he might make it stick. To Amos's closest Israeli friends, there was never anything mysterious about his interest in psychology. Questions of why people behaved as they behaved and thought as they thought were thick in the air they breathed. You never discussed art, recalls Avishai Margalit. You discussed people. It was a constant thing, a constant puzzle. What makes others tick? It comes from the shtetl. Jews were petty merchants. They had to assess others all the time. Who is dangerous? Who is not dangerous? Who will repay the debt? Who won't repay the debt? People were basically dependent on their psychological judgment. Still, to many, the presence of a mind as clear as Amos's in a field as murky as psychology remained a mystery. How had this relentlessly optimistic person, with his clear and logical mind and zero tolerance for bullshit, wound up in a field cluttered with unhappy souls and mysticism? Amos, when he talked about it, which he usually didn't, made it seem as if it had started as a whim. When he was in his mid-40s and many of the brightest young minds in the field wanted to study with him, he sat down with a professor of psychiatry at Harvard named Miles Shore. Shore asked him how he had become a psychologist. It's hard to know how people select a course in life, Amos said. The big choices we make are practically random. The small choices probably tell us more about who we are. Which field we go into may depend on which high school teacher we happen to meet. Who we marry may depend on who happens to be around at the right time of life. On the other hand, the small decisions are very systematic. That I became a psychologist is probably not very revealing. What kind of psychologist I am may reflect deep traits. What kind of psychologist would he be? In most of psychology, Amos found little to interest him. After taking classes in child psychology and clinical psychology and social psychology, He concluded that the vast majority of his chosen field was safely ignorable. To his assigned work, he paid shockingly little attention. His classmate, Amiel Liebling, witnessed Amos's insouciance after he'd been assigned by a professor to administer an intelligence test to a 5-year-old child. The night before the work was due, Amos turned to Amnon and said, "Amnon, lie down on the couch. I'm going to ask you some questions. Pretend you are 5 years old." And he got away with it. Amos was the only student who never took notes in class. When the time came to study for some test, Amos would simply ask to see Amnon's notes. "He would read my notes once and know the material better than I did," said Amnon. It was the same way he could meet a physicist in the street, talk to him for 30 minutes without knowing anything about physics, and then tell the physicist something about physics the physicist didn't know. I first thought he was a superb, superficial person, that it was a party trick, and that was a mistake, because it wasn't a trick. It didn't help that so many of the professors seemed to be flying by the seat of their pants. The guy who had come from Scotland to teach the history of psychology was sent back when it was discovered that he had fabricated his PhD. A guy they brought in to teach a class on personality testing, a Polish Jew who had survived the Holocaust by hiding in the woods, fled the classroom in tears under questioning from Amos and Amnon. "We basically had to teach psychology to ourselves," recalled Amnon. Amos compared clinical psychology, everywhere on the rise and the field of greatest interest to their fellow students, most of whom hoped to become therapists, to medicine. If you went to a doctor in the 17th century, you were worse off for having gone. By the end of the 19th century, going to the doctor was a break-even proposition. You were as likely to come away from the visit better off as you were to be worse off. Amos argued that clinical psychology was like medicine in the 17th century, and he had lots of evidence to support his case. One day, during their second year at Hebrew University in 1959, Amnon came across a paper called The Theory of Decision-Making by a psychology professor at Johns Hopkins named Ward Edwards. "Many social scientists other than psychologists try to account for the behavior of individuals," it opened. "Economists and a few psychologists have produced a large body of theory and a few experiments that deal with individual decision-making. The kind of decision-making with which this body of theory deals is as follows. Given two states, A and B, into either one of which an individual may put himself, the individual chooses A in preference to B, or vice versa. For instance, a child standing in front of a candy counter may be considering two states. In state A, the child has 25 cents and no candy. In state B, the child has 15 cents and a 10-cent candy bar. The economic theory of decision-making is a theory about how to predict such decisions." Edwards went on to lay out a problem. Economic theory, the design of markets, public policy making, and a lot more, depended on theories about how people made decisions. But psychologists, the people most likely to test these theories and determine how people actually made decisions, hadn't paid much attention to the subject. Edwards wasn't setting himself or his field in opposition to economics. He was merely proposing that psychologists be invited, or perhaps invite themselves, to test both the assumptions and the predictions made by economists. Economists assumed that people were rational. What did they mean by that? At the very least, they meant that people could figure out what they wanted. Given some array of choices, they could order them logically, according to their tastes. For example, if they were handed a menu that listed 3 hot drinks, and they said that at some given moment they preferred coffee to tea, and tea to hot chocolate, they should logically prefer coffee to hot chocolate. If they preferred A to B and B to C, they should prefer A to C. In the academic jargon, they were transitive. If people couldn't order their preferences logically, how would any market ever function properly? If people preferred coffee to tea and tea to hot chocolate, but then turned around and chose hot chocolate over coffee, they'd never finish choosing. They'd be willing, in principle, to pay to switch from hot chocolate to tea and also to switch from tea to coffee, and then pay again to switch from coffee to hot chocolate. They'd never settle on a drink, but instead would be stuck in this mad infinite loop in which they kept paying to upgrade from the drink they had to a drink they liked better. Here was one of the predictions that economists made that Edwards thought psychologists might test. Are actual human beings transitive? If at any given moment they preferred coffee to tea and tea to hot chocolate, did they prefer coffee to hot chocolate? A few people had recently looked into the matter, Edwards noted. among them a mathematician named Kenneth May. Writing in a leading economics journal, Econometrica, May described how he had tested just how logical his own students were when asked to choose a spouse. He'd presented students with three potential mates, ranked by three qualities: how good-looking they were, how smart they were, and how much money they had. None of the three potential mates was extreme in any one way. No one was so poor, dumb, or hard on the eye as to be repugnant. Each had relative strengths and weaknesses. Each ranked highest in one category, second highest in another, and last in the third. May's students, in making their choices, never faced all three potential marriage partners at the same time. Instead, they were shown pairs and asked to choose between them. For example, they might be asked to choose between the potential mate who was the brightest, second best-looking, but poorest, and the potential mate who was the richest, the second brightest, but the least good-looking. Once the dust had settled in this flurry of decision-making, more than a quarter of the students had revealed themselves as irrational, at least from the point of view of economic theory. They decided that they would rather marry Jim than Bill, and Bill than Harry, but then also said that they would rather marry Harry than Jim. If people could buy and sell spouses like hot drinks, some large number of them would never settle on one spouse, but would instead keep paying to upgrade. Why? May didn't offer a full explanation, but he suggested the beginning of one. Because Jim and Bill and Harry each had relative strengths and weaknesses, they were hard to compare. It is just these non-comparable cases that are of interest, wrote May. Comparison of alternatives in which one is superior to the other in every respect makes for a simple but rather trivial theory. Amnon showed Ward Edwards' paper on decision-making to Amos, and Amos grew very excited. Amos will smell gold before anyone else will smell it, said Amnon, and he smelled gold. In the fall of 1961, a few weeks after Amnon flew to the University of North Carolina, Amos left Jerusalem for the University of Michigan, where Ward Edwards had moved after being fired by Johns Hopkins, supposedly for not bothering to show up for the classes he was meant to be teaching. Neither Amnon nor Amos knew much about American universities. Amnon, who had just been assigned to North Carolina by a Fulbright scholarship committee, had to pull out his Atlas of the World to find it. Amos was able to read English, but he spoke so little that when he told people where he planned to go, they assumed he was joking. How will he even survive, his friend Amiel Lieblich asked herself. Neither Amnon nor Amos saw that they had any real choice. There was nobody to teach us at Hebrew University, Amnon said. We had to leave. Both Amnon and Amos assumed that the move was temporary. They would learn whatever there was to learn about this new field of decision-making in the United States and then return to Israel and work together. The earliest sightings of Amos Tversky in the United States are anomalies in the history of Amos. In their first week of classes, fellow students saw a silent, seemingly dutiful foreigner taking notes. They looked upon him with pity. My first memory is of him being really, really quiet, recalls fellow graduate student Paul Slovic, which is funny because later on he really wasn't quiet. Seeing Amos writing from right to left, one student suggested that he might suffer from some mental disorder. He was writing in Hebrew. Stripped of the power of speech, Amos was jolted out of character. Long after the fact, Paul Slovic guessed that in his first few months away from home, Amos merely had been biding his time. Until he knew exactly what he was saying, he wouldn't say it. By the middle of his first year, Amos knew what he was saying, and from that moment, the Amos stories came thick and fast. There was the time that Amos walked into an Ann Arbor diner and ordered a hamburger with relish. The waiter said they didn't have relish. Okay, Amos said, I'll have tomato. We don't have tomato either, said the waiter. Can you tell me what else you don't have? Asked Amos. There was the time Amos had arrived late for what everyone expected would be a grueling test, given by a dreaded professor of statistics, John Milholland. Amos slid into a desk just as the test was being passed out. The room was dead silent, the students anxious and tense. As Milholland reached his desk, Amos turned to the person seated next to him and said, Forever and forever, farewell, John Milholland. If we do meet again, why, we shall smile. If not, why then? This parting was well made. Line spoken by Brutus to Cassius in Act 5, Scene 1 of Julius Caesar. He aced the test. Michigan required that all Ph.D. students in psychology pass a proficiency test in two foreign languages. Weirdly, the university didn't count Hebrew as a foreign language, but accepted mathematics. Though entirely self-taught in mathematics, Amos chose math as one of his languages and passed the test. For his second language, he picked French. The test was to translate 3 pages from a book in the language. The student chose the book, and the tester chose the pages to translate. Amos went to the library and dug out a French math textbook with nothing but equations in it. "It might have had the word donk in it," said Amos's roommate, Mel Geyer. The University of Michigan declared Amos Tversky proficient in French. Amos wanted to explore how people made decisions. To do this, he required subjects who were both captive and poor enough that they would respond to the tiny financial incentives he could offer. He found them in the maximum security wing of the Jackson State Prison near Ann Arbor. Amos offered the inmates, though only those with IQs over 100, different gambles involving candy and cigarettes. Both functioned in the jail as currency, and everyone knew what they were worth. A pack of cigarettes and a sack of candy at the prison store each cost 30 cents, or about a week's salary. The inmates could either take the gamble or sell the right to take the gamble to Amos, that is, receive a sure payout. As it turned out, the Jackson prison inmates choosing between gambles had a lot in common with Kenneth May's students when they chose between spouses. After they had said they preferred A to B and B to C, they could be induced to prefer C to A. Even when you asked them up front whether they would ever choose C over A, and they insisted that they would never do such a thing, they did it. Some thought Amos must be playing a trick on the inmates, but he wasn't. "He didn't trick the prisoners into violating transitivity," said Michigan professor Rich Gonzalez. "He used a process much like the old saying about the frog in the pot of boiling water. As the temperature increases slowly, the frog can't detect it. Obviously, the frog can detect 90 degrees versus 200 degrees, but not increments of a single degree. In some of our biological systems, we are equipped to detect big differences. In others, small ones, say a tickle versus a poke. If people can't detect small differences," Amos figured, "they might violate transitivity." Clearly, people had trouble detecting small differences. Prison inmates and Harvard students, on whom Amos also ran tests. He wrote a paper about his experiments in which he showed how one might even predict when people would be intransitive. And yet, he didn't read much into this. Rather than draw some grand conclusions about the inadequacy of existing assumptions about human rationality, he pulled himself up short. "Is this behavior irrational?" he wrote. "We tend to doubt it. When faced with complex multidimensional alternatives such as job offers, gambles, or political candidates, it is extremely difficult to utilize properly all the available information. It wasn't that people actually preferred A to B and B to C and then turned around and preferred C to A. It was that it was sometimes very hard to understand the differences." Amos didn't think that the real world was as likely to fool people into contradicting themselves as were the experiments he had designed. The man whose work had pulled Amos to Michigan, Ward Edwards, turned out to be more appealing to Amos on the page than in the flesh. After Johns Hopkins fired him, Edwards found a place in Michigan, but his position was insecure, and so was he. When students arrived to work with him, he gave each of them a pompous little lecture. They called it the key lecture. Edwards would hold up the key to the door of the small house that served as his lab and tell the student what an honor it was for him to be entrusted with the key and, by extension, an association with Edwards. "You got this key along with the speech," says Paul Slovic. "The meaning of the key, the symbol of the key, it was all a little weird. Usually someone just gives you a key and tells you to make sure you lock the door when you leave." Edwards hosted a party at his house for some visiting scholar and charged his guests for the beer. He sent Amos out to do research for him and then withheld his expenses until Amos put up a fight. He insisted that any work Amos did in his lab was at least in part the property of Ward Edwards, and thus any paper that Amos wrote should also have Ward Edwards's name on it. Amos liked to say that stinginess was contagious and so was generosity, and since behaving generously made you happier than behaving stingily, you should avoid stingy people and spend your time only with generous ones. He paid attention to what Edwards was up to without paying a lot of attention to Edwards himself. The University of Michigan was then, as it is now, home to the world's largest department of psychology. There were others in it thinking about decision-making, and Amos found himself drawn to one of them, Clyde Coombs. Coombs drew a distinction between the sorts of decisions in which more was better and more subtle decisions. For instance, other things being equal, Just about everyone would decide to take more money rather than less and to accept less pain rather than more. What interested Coombs were the fuzzier decisions. How does a person decide where to live, or whom to marry, or, for that matter, which jam to buy? The giant food company General Mills had hired Coombs in hopes that he might create for them tools to measure their customers' feelings about their products. But how do you measure the strength of a person's feelings for Cheerios? What kind of scale do you use? A person might be twice as tall as another person, but might he like something twice as much? One place might be 10 degrees hotter than another place. Could one person's feelings for a breakfast cereal be 10 degrees hotter than another's? To predict what people would decide, you had to be able to measure their preferences. But how? Coombs thought about the problem first by framing decisions as a series of comparisons between two things. In the mathematical model he built, the choice between, say, two potential spouses became a multi-stage process. A person had in mind some ideal spouse, or a set of traits that he wanted in a spouse. He compared each of the real-world choices of spouse to the ideal, and chose the spouse who most closely resembled the ideal. Coombs obviously didn't think that when people chose something, they actually did any such thing. He didn't know what they did. He was just trying to build a tool that would help to predict what human beings would choose when faced with an array of things to choose from. To explain what he was up to, and probably to make it seem less preposterous, Coombs used the example of a cup of tea. How did a person decide how much sugar to put in his tea? Well, he had some notion of the ideal sweetness of tea. He sugared his tea until it most closely resembled that ideal. A lot of life decisions, Coombs thought, were like that, only more complicated. Take the decision of whom to marry. Presumably, people held in their minds at least some vague notion of an ideal spouse, a set of traits they thought important, though perhaps all not equally so, and then chose a person from the available pool who most closely resembled that ideal. To understand the decision, you obviously needed to figure out how much weight people placed on various traits. To a man in search of a wife, how important is intelligence versus looks, or looks versus personal finances? You also needed to figure out how people assessed those traits in the first place. How a woman seeking a husband, say, compared her notional ideal of a husband to the man she has just met. How on earth does a woman decide how similar the sense of humor of the guy sitting across the speed dating table from her is to her ideal sense of humor? Our decisions, Clyde Coombs thought, might be treated as a collection of judgments about the similarity between two things, the ideal in our head and the object on offer. Amos was as fascinated as Coombs by questions of how to measure what couldn't be observed, so interested that he taught himself the math he needed to do it. But he also saw that the attempt to measure these preferences raised another question. If you were going to take as your possibly unrealistic working assumption the proposition that people made choices by comparing some ideal in their head and the real-world versions, you had to know how people made such judgments. Similarity judgments, psychologists called them, in a rare example of comprehensible trade jargon. What goes on in the mind when it evaluates how much one thing is like or not like another. The process is so fundamental to our existence that we scarcely stop to think about it. It's the process that grinds away constantly and generates much of our understanding and response to the world, says Berkeley psychologist Dacher Keltner. First of all, it's how do you categorize things? And that's everything. Do I sleep with him or not? Do I eat this or not? Do I give to this person or not? Is that a boy or a girl? Is that a predator or prey? If you solve how the process works, you solve how we know things. It's how knowledge about the world is organized. It's like the thread that is woven through everything in the mind. The reigning theories in psychology of how people made judgments about similarity all had one thing in common. They were based on physical distance. When you compare two things, you are asking how closely they resemble each other. Two objects, two people, two ideas, two emotions. In psychological theory, they existed in the mind as they would on a map or on a grid or in some other physical space, as points with some fixed relationship to each other. Amos wondered about that. He'd read papers by Berkeley psychologist Eleanor Roche, who in the early 1960s was exploring how people classified objects. What makes a table a table? What makes a color its own distinctive color? In her work, Roche had asked her subjects to compare colors and judge how similar they were to each other.
People said some strange things. For instance, they said that magenta was similar to red, but that red wasn't similar to magenta. Amos spotted the contradiction and set out to generalize it. He asked people if they thought North Korea was like Red China. They said yes. He asked them if Red China was like North Korea, and they said no. People thought Tel Aviv was like New York, but that New York was not like Tel Aviv. People thought that the number 103 was sort of like the number 100, but that 100 wasn't like 103. People thought a toy train was a lot like a real train, but that a real train was not like a toy train. People often thought that a son resembled his father, but if you asked them if the father resembled his son, they just looked at you strangely.
The directionality and asymmetry of similarity relations are particularly noticeable in similes and metaphors, Amos wrote. We say Turks fight like tigers and not tigers fight like Turks. Since the tiger is renowned for its fighting spirit, it is used as the referent rather than the subject of the simile. The poet writes, "My love is as deep as the ocean," not "the ocean is as deep as my love," because the ocean epitomizes depth. When people compared one thing to another, two people, two places, two numbers, two ideas, they did not pay much attention to symmetry. To Amos, and to no one else before Amos, it followed from this simple observation that all the theories that intellectuals had dreamed up to explain how people made similarity judgments had to be false. Amos comes along and says, "You guys aren't asking the right questions," says University of Michigan psychologist Rich Gonzalez. What is distance? Distance is symmetric. New York to Los Angeles has to be the same distance as Los Angeles to New York, and Amos said, "Okay, let's test that. If on some mental map, New York sits a certain distance from Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv must sit precisely the same distance from New York." Yet you needed only to ask people to see that it did not. New York was not as much like Tel Aviv as Tel Aviv was like New York. What Amos worked out was that whatever is going on is not a distance, says Gonzalez. In one swoop, he basically dismissed all theories that made use of distance. If you have a distance concept in your theory, you are automatically wrong. Amos had his own theory, which he called features of similarity. He argued that when people compared two things and judged their similarity, they were essentially making a list of features. These features are simply what they notice about the objects. They count up the noticeable features shared by two objects. The more they share, the more similar they are. The more they don't share, the more dissimilar they are. Not all objects have the same number of noticeable features. New York City had more of them than Tel Aviv, for instance. Amos built a mathematical model to describe what he meant and to invite others to test his theory and prove him wrong. Many have tried. Before he traveled to Stanford in the 1980s to study for his doctorate with Amos, Rich Gonzalez had read Features of Similarity several times. Upon arrival, he found his way to Amos's office, introduced himself, and asked what he thought was a killer question. "What about a three-legged dog?" "Two three-legged dogs are obviously more similar to each other than a three-legged dog is to a four-legged dog. Yet a three-legged dog shares exactly the same number of features with a four-legged dog as it does with a three-legged dog. Ergo, an exception to Amos's theory." I went in thinking, "I'm outsmarting Amos," recalls Gonzalez. He just looked at me like, "Really? That's the best you can come up with?" I think there might have been an initial glare, but then he was nice about it, and he said, "The absence of a feature is a feature." Amos had written that into his original paper. "Similarity increases with the addition of common features and or deletion of distinctive features." From Amos's theory about the way people made judgments of similarity spilled all sorts of interesting insights. If the mind, when it compares two things, essentially counts up the features it notices in each of them, it might also judge those things to be at once more similar and more dissimilar to each other than some other pair of things. They might have both a lot in common and a lot not in common. Love and hate, and funny and sad, and serious and silly. Suddenly, they could be seen, as they feel, as having more fluid relationships to each other. They weren't simply opposites on a fixed mental continuum. They could be thought of as similar in some of their features and different in others. Amos's theory also offered a fresh view into what might be happening when people violated transitivity and thus made seemingly irrational choices. When people picked coffee over tea and tea over hot chocolate and then turned around and picked hot chocolate over coffee, they weren't comparing two drinks in some holistic manner. Hot drinks didn't exist as points on some mental map at fixed distances from some ideal. They were collections of features. Those features might become more or less noticeable. Their prominence in the mind depended on the context in which they were perceived. And the choice created its own context. Different features might assume greater prominence in the mind when the coffee was being compared to tea, caffeine, than when it was being compared to hot chocolate.